At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologizes to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? Get a slap?
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Now then, let's start with the live action. So already this evening, Burnley have beaten Crystal Palace by a goal to nil. Half-time just coming to a close, as in second half just starting, I should say, between Wolves and Southampton. Let's check in at Molineux. Alex Winter.
It's Wolves nil, Southampton at the break. Wolves adjusting to no Connor Cody here tonight, adjusting to a new back four as well. But they may well be ahead, were it not for McCarthy in their Southampton goal, because he's pulled off three tremendous saves to keep the scores level. First, a diving stop to his left with a nice Semedo. Dendonka with a follow-up. He saved with his shoulder, the ball flying over the crossbar. And then a flicked header from Pedence from a Martino free kick that he scooped over the crossbar. Wonderful stuff from McCarthy. But Saints have threatened at the other end. Armstrong played in of Theo Walcott, and a shot was saved down low by Patricio to his right-hand side. And then Armstrong was played in himself, stretching under pressure from Kilman, can only drag his shot wide. It's 0-0.
Now, later on, we'll hear Stephen Doyle chatting to Brian Kerr, but first, very happy to say Dion Fanning is with us. Good evening.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks so much for the time. There's loads to discuss. The weekend that was, there has finally been an official finale, full stop, put to the end of video/speechgate for Stephen Kenny, which I think is good. And news today, I mean, look, it's still an incredibly tough time, obviously, but in the midst of vaccines emerging with 90% plus efficacy, now comes news that from, well, next week, really, crowds of 4,000 will be returning to sporting events in England. They're introducing tiered restrictions that will come into force at the end of their national lockdown next week. The proposal would see 4,000 spectators allowed outdoors at games in tier one areas, i.e. areas which are have the lowest rates of COVID, and 1,000 people at indoor events. So that's very promising news. I mean, 4,000 would create a certain din at stadiums that is sadly missing at the moment.
Yeah, I would be amazed if it did happen next week, though. If you read the restrictions on how they're going to be rolled out, there are three tiers. There are going to be three tiers in England from next week. And as you say, the lowest tier will allow 4,000 spectators. The middle tier will allow 2,000. But I would expect that most places, like Britain is in a, England is in a full lockdown now, and the expectation is that most places will exit the lockdown to go into the top tier or the highest tier of restrictions. Now, maybe some places you might get some football league grounds in certain places where they can have 2,000 or it's 2,000 or 50% of capacity, whichever is lower. And right now, we don't know what the criteria for being in the tiers are. And there's going to be a certain number of factors obviously involved in that. But it will be great. It is moving. It is, you say, it's not, I think, God, I sound like the people we've all got a bit tired of who want to see, as it's parodied when the vaccine is 95% effective, they say, well, there's a 5%, it's 5% ineffective. it is good news, but Britain, England has been here before. They were trying, I think the problem with the British government is that they have been here before. They've tried to do things before. They tried to get people back to work. They tried to get, they were talking about, I don't know, was it in July that Boris Johnson was talking about having people, you know, hugging each other at Christmas again. And they were going to bring fans back into stadiums in October. And they were going to start trialing it from then. And obviously then they had to abandon that. Right now, this looks more solid and looks more concrete than those plans. Mm. And I think the one thing you can probably say for Boris Johnson right now is he does seem to have learned, temporarily at least, not just from the mistakes made during a pandemic, but from a lifetime of mistakes. And he's trying to actually speak reasonably and cautiously about this. So it would be great if it happened next week. I saw, you know, people saying that they could, you know, Arsenal could have fans at their Europa League match in a week, because if London went into tier two, maybe London could go into tier two, but you know, the expectation would be that most of the big cities and the big club, you know, where the big clubs are and where the dense population is, are going to remain in a high tier for the meantime. But it is a good sign, and it's clearly it's needed. I see Daniel Levy has come out and said we're ready. We're ready to let fans in. We have a £1.4 billion stadium sitting empty, and I think, you know, they're projected Spurs or think they're going to lose revenue of, I think, 150 million this year if there's no fans let in. And I think they're not going to be at any point where they can let fans that are going to make any discernible impact on their balance sheet in until the last couple of months of the season. But again, it is good. And maybe at that stage, when, you know, when people start getting vaccines, when we can use our vaccine cert to buy a ticket for a concert or a game, that's when things will start beginning to feel like they're going back to normal.
Meanwhile, Dean, the FAI released a statement last night bringing to an end their investigation, which just a few days earlier was urgent. You know, they went to the trouble of talking about how urgently the situation needed to be investigated. The FAI decided it was appropriate to look into the matter being Stephen Kenny's speech following the video, which caused some consternation amongst a number of the Irish staff, players. We're not quite sure numbers. Since then, they say the FAI has had discussions with a number of staff members and players, including the team manager, Stephen Kenny. The board has accepted the explanations provided and considers the matter is now closed. Now, we understand Seamus Coleman and Shane Duffy both voiced their support for Kenny over the matter. Robbie Brady chimed in as well. The video, a subject of much speculation, certainly seems like interspersed with famous Irish goals against English teams down the years, acknowledged the famine, acknowledged 1916, had the Wembley scoreboard doctored with 1916 on it. I think the Proclamation of Independence was in there. David Walsh yesterday in the Sunday Times said that there was a clip of In the Name of the Father in this video. I mean, who knows? I don't know. It's right behind the Roy Keane MUT video. And in terms of videos, I really wish I could see. And by all accounts, yesterday in all the Sunday papers, the speech that Stephen Kenny gave afterwards was deemed more problematic than the video, which was described ultimately as relatively tame. So that puts a bit of a full stop on this whole thing, thankfully. What was your read on the whole thing?
I think you can think that the idea of having an investigation over something like this, you can think that's ridiculous, while kind of slumping in your seat a little at the idea that this is what Stephen Kenny thought was a good idea in terms of motivation and inspiring an Ireland team. And I think you can hold both ideas simultaneously. You know, like somebody talked to me, mentioned something to me about it last week, and said, you know, there was just, you know, he just dealt in some facts about the relationship between Ireland and England. And, you know, that might be the case, but it's why do you want to frame what your Ireland team is in terms of 1916, the idea that you would end with a shot of Wembley and 1916 on it, on the video. It doesn't merit any investigation. But for those of us who kind of think Stephen Kenny really deserves time and is the right manager for the Ireland job, it is a little bit of a disappointment to think that he's using methods that, forget about the nationalistic element of it for a second, but that are just so crude and basic. And I was kind of thinking, like, you know, we now all obviously refer to him as Boss Man Steo from the WhatsApp, you know, the fake WhatsApp. But I was kind of reminding me, do you remember Big Ron Manager? Do you remember that series of mm-hmm. Big Ron and Bleo? He's like Boss Man Bleo. Like the guy who, you know, I remember Bossman Leo did the classic of like what the opponents had said about the team. He put it up on the dressing room wall, but he printed it in too small a font. So he had it up in the, you know, they'd said, you know, we're going to walk all over this lot or whatever. And, dismissive comments that day's opponents had made about the team, but he'd actually pinned it up he pinned it up in the dressing room wall, which is the, you know, the cliched question, will you be pinning this up in the dressing room wall? He'd done that, but he just made it too small. So the players were kind of squinting at this motivational tech and tool, and someone had to kind of walk over and look a bit closer at it, which kind of, you know, it's harder to get revved up by something if you're kind of squinting at it. And I think, in that regard, this is kind of, if you're wondering why are we watching this, what, you know, a group of players, all, you know, some of them born in the 21st century, you know, like wondering why are we dealing with this, and what relevance does it have for what we're going to do in this game, in this friendly game? So I'm glad I'm glad it's closed. I'm really glad there's been no consequences from it. But I think it's still disappointing.
Yes, it's not the manager.
And in the name of the father, didn't happen. I think David Walsh must have just picked up that. I think nobody thinks in the name of the father happened. Considering it seemed to be a rumor. It was a rumor started on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I don't think that was
part of it.
That was part of it.
No. Yeah. I don't think anybody really was too offended. I mean, rebel songs have been a staple of the bus by all accounts for a long time, and it is an aspect to Irish culture, I suppose, and I'm sure the rugby team playing England at Croke Park bought into the history a little bit. But I suppose, as you've said, for those of us who are right behind Kenny because of the style of football he's planning to play and the way he's clearly connected with the under-21 team and all of these various things, it's definitely not the image I had of what's going on behind the scenes in the camp. You know, this was not what I thought was going on. And I'm sure there were people in the room who have English partners, who have English-born children, English mother, English father. You know, I don't think Dominic Calvert-Lewin is the beating heart of imperialism. It just all seemed a touch misguided. Now, this may all be like 15 minutes and the rest of the preparation is spot on and exactly what we're hoping for, but it just seemed like the wrong route to frame a friendly game against England in. You know, that was kind of the disappointing thing, that it's just not what you're suspecting has been going on in the background. I think it's one of those things, ultimately, if the tenure goes well, and, you know, this has not been an easy start for reasons beyond Stephen Kenny's control. If the tenure goes well, this is quickly forgotten, and probably rightfully so. But if things don't work out, when you're reading the various timelines in a couple of years, it'll be one of the things just pointed to as an example of some misguided steps, I think.
Well, I think in terms of what Stephen Kenny has to do, and this is the unfortunate reality for any manager who's appointed from the League of Ireland, and you know, Brian Kerr had to deal with this as well to a degree, is just establishing your credentials. And like, that's the criticism that's leveled at, you know, when people are skeptical about appointments like this. I think football has progressed to such an extent that it shouldn't be an issue. But again, management is all about establishing your authenticity and your ability to do that job. And it doesn't really matter what you've done previously once you can do that. You're right, like, this is, and the problem with this is that this is blown way out of proportion,
yeah,
in terms of what percentage of the preparation for the game this was involved in. Like, Stephen Kenny's entire game plan didn't revolve around
this video and speech, correct?
Music and somebody poetically reading the proclamation. Like, that's not...
I like to think of Duffer doing that part, but go on.
but clearly what he does.
Yeah.
But so, like, that's true, and that's a fair comment. But it's not... If you are struggling, and you're clearly struggling, maybe not in terms of persuading the dressing room, but you're clearly struggling in terms of getting results, right, you know, at this point. And in any football dressing room, the thing you will always hear is how players are going to look for weaknesses in it. In the manager. And if it's, you know, like, going back, and this takes it beyond, like, and this goes back to, you know, I remember in Brian Kerr's time as Ireland manager, like, the criticism was, and this was completely invalid as a criticism, and it really spoke a lot to what Irish players had kind of been used to, but their criticism was that there were too many meetings, there was too much, preparation. There was too much preparation.
Not enough rebel songs, too much information.
Yeah, exactly. I remember, you know, before a friendly game against Canada, hearing a player coming out of a team meeting, and he was just saying, "I'm just sitting there staring into space." This was when you could actually be around those, you know, you were in the team hotel. Mm. This was a throwaway comment, but clearly the players were kind of, in some of these meetings, they were bored, or they were wondering what they were doing there. Now, did that have an impact? Do all these things add up or accumulate into forming a group's perception of a manager? Perhaps, or does it matter? If Stephen Kenny has beaten, if Ireland beats Slovakia, probably none of this matters.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think this stuff is useful in terms of actually getting teams to play. You could be very, very pointed about it and say it clearly wasn't useful in terms of getting a team to play. Although maybe that was Ireland motivated by the thoughts of 1916 and the famine, and you know, it would have been a lot worse if they hadn't played the motivational video. Mm. But clearly it was wrong. Before you play a game against England in an empty Wembley Stadium where there's no atmosphere and it's a friendly, it seems like something that isn't really thought through that much. And I don't see how it would have much of a positive impact with the team. Clearly, like, most of the team are saying it was nothing. Mm. And that's why maybe we're talking about it, you know, we are talking about it too much, because most of them are shrugging it off and saying it's nothing. And maybe they're shrugging it off in terms of what it says about Stephen Kenny as a manager too.
Mm.
which I think is a more interesting and probably more consequential part of the conversation than the, you know,
as opposed to the offence caused.
But that's the one thing that I would have, and I agree with you. Like I this is not what you really. And we know Stephen Kenny is engaged by things. We know that it's one of the things that makes him interesting is that he's somebody who is aware of the world that's going, you know, and what's going on. But I think we need. I think all this is fine, and is all. I would be concerned, and I'm not saying that this is what's happening with this, but I would be concerned with anything which says there is a very narrow, you know, a very narrow path of Irish identity, and you must respond to the 1916 proclamation. You must feel some visceral, something must stir in you when you hear those words, or this, when, you know, the history of Irish teams is, and I was writing about this in the Currency at the weekend about Jack Charlton's teams, that, like, you know, even predating Charlton, you had someone like Seamus McDonough who demonstrated his Irishness by reciting the proclamation. And you also had players like John Aldridge who came into the team with the words, you know, I was always very fond of my great gran. Like that was, you know, they, but it didn't make any difference. Like it didn't, now Jack Charlton was pragmatic in those terms, but it didn't, nobody was saying, let's have some identity tests. Let's have some, like the Norman Tebbit test in England in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Let's find out where your allegiance really, because, and I think we've made this point before, like when we are going to, we're going to be in a situation as a country where we're going to be picking, we're, because of the multicultural shift in Ireland, the very welcome multicultural shift in Ireland, we are going to be picking players who are born here who may not feel, have the same, may not feel the same about the, this country as we expect people to do. They may have divided allegiances. Does that matter? Of course it doesn't.
No.
It doesn't matter. And these shouldn't be the questions, or these shouldn't be the issues that you use to define Irishness. And I'm not saying that that's what Stephen Kenny is doing at all. And I don't believe he would ever do that. But a lot of, let's put it this, a lot of the online reaction to this story was framed in those terms. And then it was like, let's find the leak. Let's find, you know, the tout.
Yeah, the rat, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't like that, and, yeah.
And I don't think that's, I would be very, I would, wouldn't be surprised at all if that's not how this story came out. But that's, so sorry, that's the thing I would be, I as a consequence of it, I wouldn't, I would be concerned about too.
Yeah. To wrap this up then, so Sean in Galway, and by the way, there are texts to the other effect saying that it should be a bigger deal, but Sean in Galway, you've just spent 10, 12 minutes talking about something you said wasn't important. More media muck, making a bullshit big deal out of nothing. Sean, just in response to that, the FAI released a statement on Thursday saying they were investigating an incident surrounding the Irish team manager, and that people in the squad and on the staff, we don't know how many, were offended. And the FAI released a statement last night concluding their investigation. And we're a three-hour sports show, and it's a Monday, and we're looking back at the weekend. So 10 to 12 minutes, I think that sounds about fair to me. I think that sounds about fair to me, Sean. So it's not nothing when the FAI released a statement. I'm not so sure they should have gone so public initially on that. It just adds to the whole thing. That demands attention. That demands scrutiny, Sean. So I think it's odd if we don't talk about it. On the weekend that was, if people didn't catch all the games, things are coming together a little bit under Frank Lampard. 2-0 win against Chelsea, 6 clean sheets and 7 suddenly. We had Brighton beating Villa 2-1. Spurs 2, Manchester City 0. It's getting interesting as well under Jose at the moment. Top of the league, first time in 6 years, Spurs top of the league. Manchester United 1-0 win against West Brom. Penalty decision, little bit generous, and then retaken. And then on Sunday, Fulham 2, Everton 3, Fulham in the relegation zone. Sheffield United are going down by the looks of things early doors, which is some turnaround. 1 point from 9 games, they lost to West Ham 1-0. Leeds hit the woodwork 3 times against Arsenal, but it was a nil-all draw at Elland Road. And then Liverpool 3, Leicester 0. So where do you want to start, Dion? Obviously the Liverpool win, 64 matches unbeaten at home, record-breaking 1981, the last time they went 63 games unbeaten. So Liverpool and Spurs' win over City, the two bigger talking points. What caught your eye?
I think those two are the... I think the re-emergence of you know, Jose Mourinho and his establishment as a kind of, you know, beloved figure kind of reminds me of like when Steve Davis kind of, you know, when these invincible people suddenly seem a little less invincible. They become a little bit more beloved. Now it's hard to imagine. I don't think it's hard to imagine that with Mourinho, given the manner in which he has never been beloved.
But he'd almost fallen so far. He was approaching underdog status, and even pre-lockdown things were looking really bad. Kane and Son were injured. This didn't look right. Gary Neville was on the record as saying he doesn't think Kane is enjoying football under Mourinho. And now he's playing like a number six, come 10, come nine.
Yeah, and he and the two of them are ideally suited to a Jose Mourinho side that's functioning, and B, the attritional demands of a pandemic season and the amount of games that teams have got to play. And if Spurs can do what they did against Manchester City and counterattack and have Kane and Son there to finish it off, they really are kind of equipped to do this. And I think Mourinho, I actually do think the all or nothing as well actually has helped towards Mourinho is such a, like, you know, that show doesn't exist without Mourinho and his personality in that. I don't know. I think that has maybe altered perceptions towards him a little bit too. But you're right. I think it's like, because Spurs did seem doomed with him, and it seemed like this is going to be not a kind of a spectacular conclusion like happened at Chelsea the second time, or you know, a club like Manchester United, which is so big, and then you add in Mourinho and his toxicity, and you have these fireworks and these explosions and this poison kind of emanating everywhere. It just seemed like a club who have hired Mourinho because he is actually bigger than them, really, in modern football terms. And he can't do anything with them. That's how it seemed before the pandemic. And right now, and it's only, you know, it's nine games in, but it is... It does, something does seem to have changed, and it was, you know, it was a classic Mourinho performance and a classic Mourinho performance against Pep Guardiola, and that's what's interesting about him right now, and that he did it again, and that he actually, I think, the satisfaction he said on Match of the Day on Saturday, he was going to go home, you know, watch Atletico Barcelona and then sleep like an angel. I think the idea that he had done this to Pep again, was probably, you know, contributing to that.
The City thing is just astounding, really. They're 13th, like, you're at the point of writing them out of the league race already, which seems a touch premature, but you know, we're not far off that. 3 wins from 8 games, like, on a whole bunch of metrics. From the seemingly inconsequential to, you know, the core one of how many goals they're scoring, everything is down. Like, against a Pep team last season, generally you would only manage 8 passes from your own kick-out before you'd be tackled. Now that's just crept up to 11. You know, just the intensity isn't quite there. And then the goal scoring is 8 matches, 10 goals. I mean, the last 3 years, it was 27, 21 and 30 goals. Sergio Aguero obviously is missing. He scored 8 goals at this period last year, so they've all evaporated. Like, this thing is just grinding to some kind of a halt now. They seem almost at times predictable, which was the antithesis of what they were. There's like speed in the team at times. De Bruyne feels like he's carrying too much on his own. This is really worrying. They're going to have to go to the transfer market in a big way over the next year.
Well, yeah, you see, I think like the strange ingredient in everything you're saying is if you had said everything you just said, the logical conclusion, and I think the thing many observers would have concluded about Manchester City at this point under Guardiola would be that, well, clearly at the end of this season, Pep will just go, will walk away and do something else. Like he has reached the end. He is so demanding. He asks so much from the players. You can only do that for a certain amount of time. And there are plenty of stories about how the players have grown, just find it just wearing working for somebody of Pep's intensity for so long. And all those metrics that you point to would suggest, right, that's what's happened. It's, you know, the Aguero factor is a huge factor. But there are, as you say, there are a load of other metrics that suggest that it is a team that is just run out of gas in lots of ways. And that would be the logical conclusion to what you saw on Saturday, if it wasn't for the fact that the day before Pep signed a new contract or a contract extension. That is the bewildering thing, to be honest. To see if Pep can rebuild his side, and it needs, as you say, it does need a huge amount of work. To see if he can do that, is asking him to do something that he's never done before.
Yes, because he can't have 2 years of staying where they are now, or even worse. You know, like he'll end it, or someone will pull the plug. So he obviously feels he's got it in him. It just doesn't look much like it at the moment.
No, it doesn't, and I don't think he does. To be honest, I don't. Again, with a club like City and the ability they have to go out and buy players and spend money, and maybe again, when we come back to pandemic football, and certainly post-pandemic consequences. When, Spurs, who thought they would be competing with their huge stadium, which they could not just have football matches in, but have American football matches in, have concerts in, get lots of revenue in through that. That's been cut off for them for a year. Clubs like Liverpool, who need revenue too, that's been cut off for them for a year. So maybe a club like Manchester City thinks they can actually compete quickly and change things quickly in the transfer market. But I don't know. I think, that key problem that Pep Guardiola's side, Pep's way of managing, this looks like, if you were talking about these rumors, if you're talking about this idea and like the idea of Pep's intensity, and you were looking at a Manchester City side playing differently, you think, well, that's just gossip. That's just nonsense. You're wasting your time. You could accuse us again of spending long time talking on a story that didn't really matter. But that performance and their league position, and their lack of goals, the lack of does everything about it.
Yeah,
does suggest that is the problem. And now it is a question of can he do it again? And it's a very big question.
Mm. Dion, we're right out of time. Thanks so much. Great stuff.
Thanks, Joe.
Cheers. That's Dion Fanning. Southampton have equalised at Molineux. It's 1-1 there. We're going to hear from Brian Kerr chatting to Stephen Doyle next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
About 10 minutes to go at Molineux. Let's check in with Alex Winter.
It's Wolves 1, Southampton 1, and Pedro Neto has the equaliser for the home side. A right foot stroke from Raul Jimenez from the top of the penalty area struck the left hand post, and it fell very, very kindly for Neto straight to the Wolves front man, and he turned home basically into an empty net with his left boot. Just before that, Theo Walcott could have made it 2 for Saints, but that miss has allowed Neto to level the scores. It's Wolves 1, Southampton 1.
Now, we have Premier League commentary here every Sunday and Off the Ball. Yesterday, the half-four game was Leeds against Arsenal, finished 0-0. Stephen Doyle commentated on it with Brian Kerr.
Well, it finished Leeds United 0, Arsenal 0 at Elland Road in the Premier League this afternoon. And Brian Kerr, you were watching that match with me. Leeds, perhaps, considering they were a man up in the second half and also hit the crossbar and hit the post three times, they'd be a little bit disappointed after that game, I'd say.
Yeah, they'd be annoyed and frustrated that they didn't win the game against 10 men in the second half for so long, and having dominated the first half when it was 11-11 also. Might have got away with a couple of little things later on, that opportunity where Aubameyang's shot was blocked by Cooper. I thought it might have been a penalty for handball also. Saka put through by Bellerin, beautiful piece of work on the right-hand side, and Bellerin threaded the ball between four Leeds defenders to put Saka in. The goalkeeper, Millier, came out and forced him a little bit wide and made the save in the end, but there was a chance for Saka to score. But other than that, it was all Leeds, and they had numerous half opportunities, I would say, to score. A couple of really clear ones. The one right late on with Rafinha, I thought, was a really clear one. Bamford's header was a half chance on a cross off the inside of the post. Rodrigo, several good attempts, but the one that he flashed off the crossbar with his left foot was a great effort and goal. Dallas's was a chance. Magnificent save by Leno to his right. But it was all Leeds, really, and they played very, very well.
It's funny because there's maybe parallels with both teams. Leeds back in the Premier League, one of the great clubs in English football, trying to get back to the great Leeds team that they were. We've seen them winning league championships over the last couple of decades. Arsenal as well, who are a team, one of the great Premier League clubs, have slipped away over the last number of years. So two managers that are trying to get clubs, big clubs, back to their former glory days. But I suppose then when you look at the fact that they're going into the international break off the back of really bad defeats, they'd be just happy maybe to get that scorer's draw, keep a clean sheet, and then see where they can build from here.
Well, from the point of view of Leeds, to have a clean sheet was very good. I think it's 21 home games since they've had a clean sheet. That's some statistic for a team that won the league last year by 10 points. But overall, I think given that they've conceded 17 goals in the first 8 games of this season, it was... you wouldn't be optimistic going into every match. But that's not the attitude of Bielsa. Bielsa's attitude is that it seems to be about all-out attack, aggressive, been on the front foot, irrespective of what position you're in on the field. So, you know, playing that way, you're bound to concede opportunities, and the better the opposition is, the more likely you're going to convert those opportunities into goals. Today, Leeds didn't cough up many opportunities to Arsenal. They made them look quite ineffective, really. So that was good. They made a lot of chances themselves. They didn't take them. They looked inventive. The passing was quite good. The pitch was very soft, I'd say, which didn't help the players' footing. From Arsenal's point of view, they kept a clean sheet when they were down to 10 men. I think that was probably the best you could say about Arsenal, whether they were disciplined in the second half apart from the red card. They got into good defensive positions. They were brave. They got their bodies in the way, made some good blocks. The goalkeeper dug them out when need be, and they had a big slice of luck with shots hitting the post. So the satisfaction from Arsenal's point of view is they didn't get beaten. For Leeds, I think they look like a team that will be comfortable enough in the Premier League this season.
So you do think Leeds will stay up?
Oh, we do, yeah. Based on what I've seen, you know, what I've seen up now in the matches, a lot of entertaining matches, lots of goals at both ends. But their general play today and the energy they play with and the confidence they have in each other to take the risks they do in getting forward into attacking position. I mean, most teams that struggle in the Premier League and they ultimately go down, it's because of the lack of goal scoring, the lack of a main man to score goals or to be able to score goals and make enough chances. You've seen that with so many teams in recent years. Norwich, for example, last year started well, Pookie got a few goals, but then the goals dried up, results fall out. I don't think Leeds are going to have that problem. Bamford has scored 7 goals already. It was unfortunate today. Leno made 2 good stops from him, from the flick in the first half, the outside of his right boot, and the kind of shot that came, the chance came off a Gabriel block, and Leno made that save, the header off the post. But Rodrigo come on, looked the player when he come on, and I think they've other good attacking options. So, and they get goals from lots of players around the pitch. Midfield players, Dallas got 5 last year. Click scores goals come at midfield. Ayling scores goals from the back. So I think they'll be okay.
And just to ask you on Arsenal then as well, Mikel Arteta has been backed in the transfer market. Now, I'm not sure he wants, or he's got everything that he needs. Some people have said he maybe needs another couple of transfer windows before he gets the team that he wants. But what's his goal this season? What's his target?
Well, his goal has to be kind of make the Champions League places. Realistically, I don't think they're going to win the league. I mean, we would have said that about 18 teams starting the Premier League this year, but only Manchester City and Liverpool could have reasonable, realistic ambitions to win the league. But now the way things have worked out, given the sort of season we have, where all the European clubs playing in Europe, playing two matches a week on a weekly basis, and then with the internationals packed in where all their players are away on international duty, the players not getting a rest, it's a real test of everyone's squad. There's no crowds in the stadiums affecting the results. So it comes down to performance on the day and the ability of the players. There's nobody influencing referees' decisions, the passions, the crowd, the hostility of the crowd, any of that is not affecting the games. So, you know, Arsenal can have ambitions of being the top four team, I think. Whether they make it or not, you would cast doubts at the moment. But the good news for them is I think they're still only finding their way. Thomas Partey hasn't really settled in as yet. Looks a promising player. Missed the game today. David Luiz missed the game today. And Lenny missed the game today. The two, Lenny and Partey look like they're part of his best midfield, and neither of them played. So, but he needs to get the front line firing, and that's the problem. They become a little bit more resilient and organised and disciplined looking, but that seems to have been at the expense of creativity. No sign of Ozil, doesn't seem to be wanted at all, and yet they're not making too many chances either. And Aubameyang looked a shadow of himself today, I have to say, compared to the fellow that scored 22 goals in the league in each of the last two seasons. He's got two thus far, Lacazette on the bench and not used today. So that area of the pitch have got to improve, but, you know, give the man time, give the man a chance. He's not had too much time. The transfer window was exceptional circumstances in the most recent transfer window. I don't think too many clubs that... Very few clubs did an awful lot of business. I think it'll take more time, and you'd have to be fair to Arteta to evaluate how he's done. I don't think we can make any real evaluation on it until much later in the season.
Brian, can I ask you about Jose Mourinho? I feel the last couple of weeks when he's speaking to media, he's got his mojo back. It's like the old Jose. His team are playing very well. They started off that dreadful day against Everton on the opening day of the season, but since then they've been really good. He's fighting on two fronts between the Europa League and the Premier League as well, and yet he's still getting wins. Last night, I know you said earlier on the radio that it was a bit slapdash at the back. They were kind of maybe trying to get back and defend against Manchester City, but they still held out and got that victory, and have, you know, Harry Kane and Son, who are in the form of their lives at the moment, they've got to be a real contender to win the title now.
Well, I wouldn't see them as a real contender. I think, I didn't mean that they were slapdash in defending. I just thought that they were a bit fortunate to get away with some of it sometimes. Yeah. I mean, Lloris had a quiet game for most of the game, but he made a couple of saves when he had to. He was a bit lucky. They were even lucky where there was an incident and a shot hit Jesus, and it was going in, and Jesus was lying on the ground and offside was given against him. But the shot was going in, had he not been there, and the flag was put up against him. And I thought that favoured Spurs. They got a little bit of luck in that instant particularly. There was a few other occasions where it just broke for them around the box. But in saying that, I thought Dyer, the centre-half partnership actually of Dyer and Alderweireld played very well. Alderweireld had a busy time in the international break. The full backs earlier was much more disciplined than usual as well. Just as a team, Højbjerg, his defensive position was very good, and Sissoko, they made it into a back six at times without the wide players. Often we see teams fall into a back six and the wingers are doubling up as full backs. But yesterday it was more Sissoko and Højbjerg were doubling up as centre halves, and Kane was dropping into midfield and affecting the game. And Dembele did all right for an hour, made critical contribution to the first goal, and look, that threat still doesn't look as mobile as he needs to be. But I would still be surprised if Spurs are in contention for the long road on this one. I think they've improved a lot. I think team spirit has improved dramatically. There's a bit of clarity about the way they're playing. I think he got one over on Pep yesterday by winning that way, because it's not the nature of Spurs. I don't think if Spurs fans were packed in the ground yesterday, they would have been delighted to see them being pinned back around their own penalty area and playing on the counter. Spurs fans want to see their team on the front foot and taking the opposition on, but they would have been delighted at that result. And that's what they're doing now. They're finding a way to just about win matches. Unfortunately, they dropped silly points to West Ham, silly points to Newcastle early on, and they lost Everton the first game where they played very poorly. But he's certainly getting a number out of a lot of players now, and the squad looks a lot better than it did.
Harry Kane perhaps could be footballer of the year at the end of the season while he's playing.
Well, we're not even a third into the season, but Harry Kane is a superb player. His goal scoring record is tremendous, and yet he didn't score again yesterday in the league, but he was the best player on the pitch.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.